We've been talking about different formwork systems, but the nitty-gritty elements of, in this case, wall form, are usually something on the inside face of the concrete. And almost all the time when we build the forms, they're made out of some kind of plywood. If we rent the forms, they'll be made out of steel or aluminum. The rental forms will usually go together a little faster. If it's plywood that you're going to be using because the building is irregular in shape or has irregular slab conditions that the rental forms just can't deal with, you'll probably have to make sure you have formwork carpenters on the job site to build your forms for you. So we've got plywood form. Of course, this thing is the tie. The tie has a cone on the end of it that actually gets embedded in the concrete, because the point of the tie is to, at the wide end of the cone, it keeps the plywood from pushing in and making the wall too skinny during a pour. And the loop on the outside, we put a hook through it and grab that so that it also keeps that tie in tension. We kind of grab cam action and pull on that tie so that it keeps the wall just the right dimension. Can't push in, can't push out under the load of the concrete. Now the ties themselves, they probably could do the job, because plywood under the weight of that wet concrete will start to bulge down at the bottom, even this three-quarter plywood. So we usually back it up with horizontal studs, horizontal 2x4s, they'll call them whalers, and vertical 2x4s in order to deal with just the weight of that wet concrete. Because until the concrete's set up, almost all the weight is at the bottom of the form. So that's usually where you're going to see your leakage start to happen. The taller the form, the more weight the concrete's going to have down at the bottom, and the more problems you're going to have. And sometimes when the concrete gets finished, you'll see these lines like this, these deep dark lines, and then these little medium lines. The deep dark lines, those are actually pour lines. Usually what we'll do, because if you're pouring appearance grade concrete, concrete that's going to be exposed, the concrete will never match from one truck or one batch to another batch. Because in the 14 days maybe between this pour and this pour, in that 14 days, maybe they got a new shipment of cement paste in at the ready mix. Maybe they got new aggregate. Something's changed. The color never matches. So by putting, in this case, they just put in a 2x2 or 1x2 in the formwork to make a shadow joint right there between pour one and pour two. They can hide a little bit of that difference between the coloration of the two pours. So the shadow joint is kind of a place where you hide the cold joint back in the shadow. Of course, the little dots that you're seeing here, those little dots are from the ties, exactly. So once we get the plywood off, we just take a vice grip and grab onto the end of that loop that's sticking out, this loop right here. Grab that loop with a tool and snap it, and right there where it's flat, it's going to snap off back in the concrete and pull out and leave us with this perfectly round little hole here. So we have those really dark shadow lines, and we use those in order to hide the difference between pour one and pour two, because they're never going to be the same. But this line in here, this sort of hint of a line here, that happens because two pieces of plywood met right there. And what do you get when you have two pieces of plywood meeting? Tool mark. And you could call it a form mark like that. And what actually causes the phenomenon? What do you get at the end of plywood? The water makes the plywood a little wider. So the plywood's trying to soak up water at that point, because the plywood's got end grain right at that point at its edges, right? So the edges are the weak spot for the plywood. It's soaking in water. And whenever you soak up water in concrete, what are you soaking with it? What would you say? Begins with a P, ends with an E. Paste. Whenever you soak paste into a form joint, you're going to get a paste-rich zone in the concrete. That means you're going to get a line, and you will never get rid of that line. Ever. Ever, ever, ever. Sandblast it once, sandblast it twice, sandblast it three times. You'll not get rid of that line. You've got to paint it. So if you've got to do exposed concrete, one, you should put more time in for yourself, because you've got to do more supervision. You've got to have better formwork carpenters, and you better make sure that when those formwork carpenters put those things together, that line lines up all the way across there, because if that line is 2 foot here and then jumps up 3 inches, because that's how big the plywood they had is, and that's not what they've got drawn, they'll be very unhappy. And almost never will a designer draw that form line. They'll just assume that you're using standard sheets all the time and not taking whatever piece of plywood is laying around. But that's what formwork carpenters do, right? Because they get paid to produce per surface contact area, square foot of contact area, SFCA. That's their unit of measure. That's how they get paid. They don't get paid by the pretty. They get paid by the SFCA. So you see how deep that shadow joint is at the pour joint. So that separates the any kind of coloration difference between pour one down here and pour two up there. And there's that plywood joint, which is not much of a coloration difference. Now, the more you use the plywood, the more likely it is to soak up the water into that end joint. It's going to become more and more absorbent. So the fewer uses you have on it, the less of a problem this is. The more uses, the more of a problem it is. So if we walked around Kogel Hall, the architecture building, we'd find all over the place where the formwork carpenter made a piece of plywood stop there on the bottom of the, this is a beam up on the third floor. Here's the bottom of the beam. There's the vertical face of the beam. This is a plywood joint in the vertical. Here's the plywood joint in the horizontal. They were so unhappy when they stripped the forms on this. They paid to sandblast this three times. And still those paste lines are there. Because the architect never drew the thing and never said in the spec that the line where the plywood ends on the beam has to line up with where the plywood ends on the bottom of the beam. Face of the beam and the bottom beam, they didn't say anything about it. So the formwork carpenter just made it there. Why is there more paste down at the bottom of that than there is up at the top? Wild guess, what do you guys say? Water runs downhill. Absolutely. Physics is really hard to overcome. But they were really unhappy. That's why when you look at the face of the concrete on the inside of that building, you see so much aggregate. It was supposed to get a light sandblast to take some of the paste off, but you can dig rocks out of this now. And the same problem happened up on the face of it. You see that where that red line flew in there? Let me try that again. This is so dramatic. So here's the line. It's a pour joint at the parapet wall. There it is. They were really, really disappointed when they pulled the forms on that. Now, why is that pour joint like that? Does that have to do with how it was designed or how it was formed or how it was poured? Who starts paying for this? What do you think? Formwork. I think so. This is how it was poured. Here's how it was formed. So they formed up this slab down here for the roof overhang. And because they were going to pour a parapet, they formed up a wall, plywood on the back side of it there. And because if you pour concrete in here first and fill this up, the concrete's just going to start to seek its own level on the back side there. So they actually formed and poured this first, poured a little concrete to make sure that was full. And they couldn't reach down because that parapet's so deep, you just couldn't get your arm down in there because there's rebar like crazy in there, right? There's number fours and number fives at 12-inch centers on both faces. You can't get a trowel. No human being could get a trowel in there and trowel that thing flat, right? So and that's what the contractor said. No, there isn't anyone alive who could have troweled that thing flat after we poured it. And that's, I think, probably true. So when they poured the top part, you know, you got new concrete poured on top of old concrete, so you get this line. If you walk out there after class and look at it, it's a scar from 1963. They will never get rid of it. Never. And you can't patch it. Don't even try because it's just going to get worse. All you can do is paint it to get rid of it. But if as a builder, yes, sir. This is a good question. Why don't we just pour all this at once? What happens if I pour that 4 feet up on top of the, if I fill the rest of this up right now? It would overflow, it would push down here and try to seek its own level on the backside because we don't have a top form on that backside to constrain it. Excellent thinking. But this is the way you could avoid it. If you ever see a concrete parapet and it's got to be exposed, all you got to do is stop the pour. You know, if it hurts when you do that, what's the answer? It hurts when I do this? Don't do it. So if every time you see a concrete parapet, just figure you're going to stop the pour back behind the parapet wall. Let the rebar run out. You're going to put a piece of wood up, and you're going to drill holes where the rebar goes through so you get continuous structural action out of it. What's this lump here for, the red lump right there? Keyway. And what's a keyway? Say it. Ties them together in shear, and the vaudeville answer is 5 ounces. Think about it. This is the way you can avoid it. So you do this, we pour the slab, we leave the rebar sticking through, so we're good to go. Now we come back, we form up that parapet wall, we just leave the bottom form on, form up the face here, pour the concrete all at once, and are we going to get that horizontal scar if we do it this way? Absolutely not. So this is value you could add in a discussion with the designers. You could say, now it's going to take me a little more time, so I need a little more money, but I can make it look exactly the way you drew it if we do it this way. And they'll say, you mean no scar? And you'll say, no scar. Pour it all at once and viola, no staining. So the formwork can really, in exposed concrete, those are the projects that you probably have to pay the most attention to your formwork, both detailing and estimating on. If they're going to be covered or painted, you don't have to worry about it, really.
Is there a reason that pouring it like this, you need a key, but pouring it the other way, you don't need a key?
Pouring it the other way, the concrete is sitting, so the pouring it this way, the weight of the parapet is being carried really off that slab.
Okay, and there's nothing underneath it.
So there's no, you're not putting this piece of concrete in shear against gravity. So when we pour it this way, this big piece of parapet wall is going to want to go down. The rebar is going to resist it, but if we can have a key in there, it would have to break the concrete in that key in order to fail downwards. So the shear key is just belt and suspenders.
How deep should that key be?
It's a 2 by, so 1.5 inches. If to shear off 1.5 inches of concrete would take a lot of force. 1.5 by 3.5 concrete. It'd take a lot of force. Take 7,000 or 8,000 pounds probably. So pour it all at once and it happens. Site cast concrete is usually considered the best construction you can do. And it is the most expensive way to build in America because of the labor, our prices of labor. In other parts of the world, it is the least expensive way to build because labor costs you nothing. And it has the less amount of steel per cubic foot of building than, say, this auditorium does. A wide flange steel beam in a lot of other parts of the world is just gold. It's like a gold bar. Rebar, on the other hand, is cheaper. So most building codes will accept cast-in-place concrete as the highest quality. And basically, it's because the concrete mass is keeping the steel from overheating. Because at 1,100 degrees, what happens to steel? What's the strength do? Half, right. So really, the curve starts to really fall off. So all the codes ask is that we get 1.5 inches of cover for fire. Now, the concrete industry says you'd like to have 2 inches to protect it against water. So if you're in that 1.5 to 2 inch zone, separation between where your rebar is and where the face of the form is, you're going to be okay. The rebar ends up closer than that to the form, it's not going to perform as well. Not going to last as long. So now we're looking at Burchard Hall. This is the back, not the corridor nearest us by the shop, but the back corridor. And we're at the mezzanine level. So the electrician has got their boxes in. And you see, this electrician's done this before. They put duct tape around all their boxes because they don't want their boxes to fill up with concrete because it makes it impossible to pull the wires through, right? So as the superintendent or the foreman, you want to make sure all those things are taped up before you pour. Because if they have a problem, what can they do? the electrical subcontractor allowed to jackhammer out your concrete to put their conduit back in and patch it? No. you don't want that to happen. And if the owner has got in mind that they're going to get a wall like this
with no surface mounted conduit,
and the electrician comes back and has to surface mount conduit to service the lights, the owner is going to be unhappy. Whenever the owner is unhappy, somebody's going to have to give money to somebody. So a few minutes of observation, making sure all the connections in the conduit are duct taped, saves you just enormous amounts of paperwork hassle later. What's this stuff? What does that look like to you? Expanded polystyrene. Why would they put expanded polystyrene in the wall? I mean, it's not going up the whole wall, so it can't be for insulation. It does absorb water, so we don't really want to leave it there because it's going to just be a place where we're going to grow mold. Why is it in there? It's making a recess for the slab so that after we pour the wall, there's going to be a keyway between the wall and the slab. The slab will be keyed into the wall. Styrofoam is really easy to dig out once you got it there, right? Actually, a little propane torch, it'll melt out. Spray a little acetone on it, which generally you shouldn't have on the job site. So here, this is the wall of Burchard that faces Kogel. These are the windows for the offices being formed. So they're basically just a box. Formwork carpenter makes them up out of 2x and plywood. And they make them the exact thickness of the wall. So they go from the back form of the wall to the front form of the wall. And what are these bars? I already got those on there, don't I? So you see those diagonal bars in there? And that's there to prevent the cracking at the corners. So these are just called holdouts. And this one's for a louver, and this one's for a door, and this one's for a window. Now these are real skinny. These are tall, narrow openings. So the chances are we're going to be able to get concrete to go underneath them. If this was a really long horizontal louver right there, what would you have to do to the formwork to not end up with a hollow spot under there? You'd have to put a door in the bottom of that form right there so that you could make sure there was concrete underneath that whole thing and then fasten it down to fill the rest of the wall. So when you're looking at value engineering a concrete project, what you're looking for is places that are hard to form. So long horizontal openings, that's a little extra effort. It's a little more risk. The only way you can manage the risk is by knowing I can just put a door in the bottom of that thing and pump that full of concrete first, fill the concrete to that level, anchor that door down with some screws, and then go back up and fill the rest of that wall. That's the kind of stuff you're looking for in concrete. And this is, when it's all done, it's a beautiful pour, isn't it? You see every nail, every screw in the formwork shows through in the concrete. So if this was an exposed concrete wall, it's not going to be very pretty. St. Louis, Missouri, there was a Japanese architect named Tadao Ando, built a building for the Pulitzer family, they're the big newspaper family, for their art collection, all exposed concrete. They hired cabinet makers to come in to build the formwork for it, so they wouldn't have this kind of ugliness. What are all those bubbles and tears? What's this from? Straight up from the plywood, right? That's a, what do they call that in plywood? A boat patch? So in formwork plywood, which is effectively, maybe it's BC plywood, it's probably just CDX on this, because we're going to cover this wall with Hokie stone, so we're not so worried about it. This is, see the shadow from that loop? That's the, what would you call that? What's causing that shadow right there? Form tie, exactly. So we snap that off. That's going to come off pretty easy. And here's the holdout from the window. And you see the plywood that we put on the face of the form didn't really fit very tight right there. So we'll just have to take a hammer and break off these little overpours in order to tear that form out. I think people do. I think there's a hole there from a formwork nail, but it just wasn't enough. You know, if that 2x isn't perfect and the face of that plywood isn't perfect, it just won't be tight enough. It's possible to actually do it in steel. I've seen them do it, so it's perfect. And they put a little bit of, it's called a form gasket. So it's a little piece of sponge rubber with adhesive on both sides. You pull the tape off and just stick it on like tape, like double stick tape, and it'll keep the concrete from leaking past the edge. So whenever you want to stop a concrete leak, you make sure you gasket that connection. The holdout could come out as soon as you strip that form. So that form was up for about 5 days. So the wall's going to be up to strength in another 20 days or so. So they can do that pretty quickly, depending on the mix and the weather. And to get that out, of course, you just got to demolish it. You're not going to reuse this. You just take a crowbar in there and just tear it apart. And that takes quite a bit of time. Now, what else is in there? What do you see here? What is this thing? What does that stuff look like to you? Styrofoam again. What's that doing? You got it that time. What's that doing in there? And there's some over here too. Or is this obvious? I'm asking another stupid obvious question. It could be. I kind of forget what I'm doing after I have a week off. Have you seen this before? Have you held this in your hand? Think about the labs and masonry. We talk about, yes, sir. Those are for the ties. In this case, it's on campus, so it's Hokie stone, but that's a dovetail slot, and that piece of styrofoam is in the dovetail slot just to keep what from happening? Keep the concrete out of it. So we're going to take a hammer, and we're going to smack the face of it and break the rest of that concrete overpour out. We're going to take a utility knife and strip out that styrofoam, so we can put our dovetail in vertically, turn it horizontally, and that V shape of the dovetail is going to give us good lateral resistance, and that continuous dovetail slot is going to let us lay that triangular wire tie in the bed joint of the Hokie stone wherever it happens, right? And I need that kind of adjustability in Hokie stone because why? Because it's a random ashlar coursing, so we can't depend on there being a line every 2 feet. It might be 2 feet one, it might be 2 feet six. We don't know where it's going to go. So we build adjustability in when we're doing concrete work. Now this one is in Hancock. So this one is the shear wall. Where is it? It's up in that corner of the building, right in the middle of the building down that corridor there. So same thing. Plywood is already up. We form one side of the wall, bring in the rebar. Corner bars are there for what? Stop cracking. And this thing is about, you know, it's probably about 8 feet across the bottom here. And that's our gas bottle for welding. They poured it and pulled it, and that's what they got. And they felt real bad because that was like right facing the architecture building. And architecture students would go out and go, nah, nah, your form didn't fill up. Which wasn't very kind of them. It wasn't too hard to fix, though, and this wasn't going to be exposed. It's all covered in a Hokie stone, so it's not a big problem. You're going to have more cold joint than you did before, but structurally it's not a disaster. If this was supposed to be an exposed concrete wall, yikes. We got a real problem then. So in exposed concrete construction, you got to pay extra attention to those things. And you could avoid that by how? Door in the bottom of that holdout. Right, exactly. A door down here. A piece of plywood that you could have out, fill the concrete, fill the walls up to that level, visually confirm that that's full, screw that piece of plywood down in that form, and then you won't have this happen. How many people does it take to place 160 cubic yards? Mean says for a 6-inch elevated slab, it takes a foreman who doesn't do the work, 5 laborers, 1 skilled finisher, 1 equipment operator. Equipment, we've got to have screed pipes and board, concrete pump, and gas vibrators. And they figure about $2,500, $2,600 for 160 yards. If we were going to use a crane in a bucket, look at the jump. And that's just the crane cost for that 110 yards there. And you always have to add the finishing. The finishing isn't part of placing. That's just cost replacing. Of course, slab on grade is a little bit cheaper, $1,300 instead of $3,000, and 70 cents to screed and finish, it's a little easier. Now we're up on the top of the roof. It's about 5:30 in the morning in July. We're at the Howard Hughes School of Engineering at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. So they've called the architect 24 hours in advance, and the architect said you can come along and take pictures, so I'm up early looking at this. This is a waffle slab pour, so this is a two-way joist slab. And the two-way joist slab, it's more efficient than a flat slab because why? It's got less concrete. We're taking out the concrete that's not working. So we're really making a network of beams that goes in both directions between these square-shaped domes, fiberglass domes, that we've laid down on a flat plywood deck. Put rebar in between them. We're walking it right now with the architect to make sure there aren't any souvenirs. We found a couple of, at that time it was Fanta pop cans down in there, and that was about it. It sits on a bearing wall, so over the bearing wall there's this big beam. It's got rebar that comes up out of the bearing wall, and then rebar from the beam that engage each other this way. So when we pour the concrete, that's going to be a pretty good connection. It's going to make the slab and that bearing wall behave as one thing, because Vegas is seismically active. So they have to be a little more conservative than we are. That's the top of that pan form. You see it's got a little rubber grommet right there. We're going to use that little rubber grommet when we strip the forms. And what's this? The chair sits up on top, and all we got is number four bars. So where we're in the top of the slab, where we're not making a beam, there's almost no steel, right? What's the steel on top of that form doing? Temperature steel, and we call it temperature steel, but what's it controlling? Shrinkage. Exactly. So that steel on the top of the slab there is just to help control cracking. Now, they had already poured half of this roof, and what they did to stop the pour was they took a one-by and they drilled holes in it and slid it over the rebar and set it on top of those forms and made a piece that went down in the form and up, down in the pan and up. I thought it was really, really way too tedious. I would have broken the pour someplace else, like on a beam. But they did it the hard way and did it kind of pretty. You think about trying to make a piece of wood that fits that form exactly as it goes down and comes back up. Not so easy. They were showing off, I think, is what they were doing. So we're getting ready to pour. Concrete trucks are going to roll up. So we've got some gas-powered vibrators here. We've got big, tall rubber boots. We've got rope, yellow rope. And, of course, we've got a couple of tires for this pour. That's in means, isn't it? You've got to bring your own old rubber tires when you're pouring. We'll see what that's for. You see, the form isn't set flat. This is a roof, so they're going to try to help the roof slope to get rid of water. What they did was they took that plywood deck and screw-adjusted those little metal scaffolding, the head of the scaffolding, to drop down those beams that support the plywood to get a slope on the roof. So water will run off the roof. So it's a pumped operation. The pump's down here. Concrete trucks are going to come up here. And I think these two guys here are driving the pump from up there by radio control. So just like the little radio-controlled compactor, they've got a little box that they wear. It's got a joystick, and it's got controls for the pump. So they can move the boom, basically, from up there. They got to have an operator still down here, though, telling them that the pump is full or the pump is empty. And they were learning how to test drive when we got there. These two guys had never done that before. So they were learning how to test drive, and you see the rebar right there? They crashed the boom into the wall right there. That was exciting. Everybody up on the forums at that time had just sort of stopped and looked. Like, oh no, is this the big one? And it was because when they poured the floor below that, they did it all on these wooden forms, these wooden shores that we have out here at, I guess it's out there, at ICTAS. And all those wooden shores, all of a sudden, they started pouring in a far corner, loading the concrete in the far corner, and the whole form rotated. And everybody jumped. Didn't collapse, but everybody bailed because they thought it was going to collapse. they heard a couple people in the jumping. So after they had that, this was the job where the superintendent ordered in the metal shoring, put the metal shoring back, took all the wood shoring out to the parking lot and lit it with a bunch of diesel fuel, made a big smoky fire. So that's where they learned. They crashed into the wall. And of course the pump is, here's the fellow driving the pump up here, and the boom is extended as far out as it can. They got two trucks to make sure that the pump never goes dry, because they got to keep pouring, they got to keep pumping until they finish that roof deck. And they'd really like to be off that roof deck by, their goal was 2 o'clock, because it gets really hot. So do I want type 3 concrete here? I'm trying to slow the concrete down here, because the heat of the day down there is gonna actually make it cure a lot faster. So I'm plasticizing it. I'm also cooling it. So they're adding, instead of adding water to the mix, they're adding crushed ice to replace the water, to keep that mix as cool as possible so it doesn't hydrate before it loses all the water to the heat of the day. So we got a big placing crew, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and there's a couple more people over here, about a dozen people. And that's because the boom is reaching as far as it can, and it can't reach the farthest part. So they've made handles for the hose out of that yellow rope, and they're dragging that hose across the top of the rebar to get to the farthest. So the hose catches on the rebar as it moves it around, so that's what the rubber tires are for. They tied the tires to the hose, so the tires would float the hose up above the rebar. And as they got it poured and they could back out, they're pouring from their furthest distance away, back, and as they get closer, they can take off extensions of the hose and get rid of the tires. So that process of pouring, and this is the plasticized concrete, is there are a couple of guys who are guiding the hose. This deck is about 30 inches deep. This total, it's a 28-inch waffle plus a 2-inch topping above the waffle. 28, I think that's right. The concrete comes out of there in a pretty fluid state. These two people make sure that form gets filled deep. This person, their job is to vibrate, drop the vibrator down into every void space between those pans. So the person doing the vibrator has more work to do here than they usually do, because they have to make sure they get into every one of those void spaces. At the end, they've made these little holdouts, because they're turning the waffle slab into a trellis, a sunshade. So they boxed out on the same module as their pans, their fiberglass pans. They made boxes here so that sunlight can go through here, but it's going to help shade it a little bit. But this will take a lot of hand work, because anytime wood meets concrete, you got to have somebody take and hand finish it with a tool to separate the concrete from the wood so it doesn't tear, doesn't spall. So once they get it placed, the next thing that happens is screeding. So this is screeding. Manual process, drag a 2x4, and usually it's a sawing motion. You pull it back and forth across bars that you've already got set at the right height. They were just putting pipes the right diameter on top of the rebar, so they knew how thick the concrete was going to be above the pans. Drag it back and forth. The third person here with the shovel, they're just watching to make sure if it piles up behind it, he takes the scoop of it and holds onto it. In case they hit a low spot, he throws that scoop of concrete in front of the screed, and they'll re-screed it. So this is the first step, bringing the concrete to the right elevation, the right level. Then after that, once it's at the right elevation, they can float it. And floating is basically a process of aligning the paste particles at the surface. So it's usually a metal float. They call this a bull float. An aluminum handle, an aluminum float, and you can reach a long way with it, so you don't have to walk into the mix. And then nobody will walk on it after it's been floated. Now out here at the trellis, they have concrete finishers who are working to make that, see the separation line right there? They're hand tooling around each one of those things, and they have to hand float the concrete out here. So this is a lot of handwork, so they had an extra 6 or 8 people just to do that finishing, that hand finishing there. Now, on really big projects, on big square footages where you don't have a lot of obstacles, you can use power trowels to do this floating. So they're either like this one, the walk behind, and it's just like a big fan blade. You can almost just see the blades here. And they just spin around real slowly, and you just move it back and forth to get a smooth finish. And that is faster than the hand float. So one of the alternatives to the project that you're working on now, if it takes too many people to finish the concrete, you could change from hand floating to power floating. And if you don't have obstacles, this thing flies back and forth. This is my favorite job on the job site. I want one of these. I want the remote control compactor, and I want the riding float. Because they'll produce a lot more work. And he's even got headlights on there so they can work at night. Now the problem with that, where can't this person go? Close to a wall or close to a column. So all the work around the columns is hand finished. If you walk down through Burchard and look at that concrete floor, this was done in the middle parts where it was wide open. Whenever you get to a column, you'll see the floor actually goes up at the column. That's because the person working it by hand doesn't weigh as much as the person on the float, on the riding float. So if your floor had to be really, really, really flat, you'd have to be especially vigilant to make sure that this doesn't result in, you can almost see a little wave in the floor here, doesn't result in a wavy floor. Concrete slabs on grade will be specified by precision levels. So they'll say like a 64th of an inch plus or minus over a 10-foot length. That's really flat. Or they'll say, no, a quarter inch over a 10-foot length. That's not very flat. If you put a string line on the floor in Kogel Hall, put it up on a 1x block at one end and stretch the string across the lobby and just measure down from that string, you'll find that floor goes up and down 3/4 of an inch in about 60 feet. It's a wild, wiggly floor. And you'll see old people every once in a while fall down on that floor because of that. It's a trip hazard. And if somebody ever came back to litigation, where is the litigation going to go? It's going to come through you. And then you're going to try to pass it through to the concrete finisher. But you'll end up with some of it because you signed the contract. So up on the roofs, they're floating, they're vibrating, they're screeding. They're getting almost all done. So they went from 5:30 a.m. They didn't hit their mark because the pump broke in the middle. And there wasn't another pump available, so they sat still. Everybody sat around in the sun for a couple hours and waited for another pump to show up. So they didn't get off till about 7:30 that night. And they poured about 6,400 square feet. Quite a lot of work. Underneath, this is the aluminum shoring they replaced all the wood shoring with. They were unhappy with the movement of it. And once that concrete is cured up, what's going to happen is this fellow's got, he's got a little shoulder strap here. He's got a compressed air tank. He takes, at the end of the rubber hose, he's got a piece of copper pipe, pushes the copper pipe up in that grommet, and puts a little squirt of compressed air between the fiberglass, top of the fiberglass, and the bottom of the concrete, and that fiberglass just pops down and easy for them to pull out because the sides of the fiberglass are sloped. Anytime you need to get something out of concrete, wood, steel, aluminum, fiberglass, if you slope the sides, it'll pull out easier. If your sides are square, you're going to have to tear it out in pieces. You just won't get it out. That side slope is called a draft. So if you have to reuse a form that's got things that stick into the concrete, make sure those things are formed with a little side slope, a draft, 1/8 of an inch per foot usually, something like that. So wherever there's one of these things, it's no problem. He squirts a little air up there, it pops down, hands it off to an assistant. But where there isn't, and where is it, where does the little grommet disappear? Do I say that there? Where won't you have the little grommet? So you have this exposed coffered ceiling. What are you going to have in that ceiling that's going to make it hard to pull some of those forms? Lighting. You're going to feed the lights, you're going to recess boxes up there in order to feed the lights. Anytime you put a hole in one of these pans, you make it so that you've got to take it out with a hammer and a crowbar. So every place where there's an electrical box, that's going to be harder to strip the form out there. So they work and they work and they work to try to get it out if it doesn't come free. This has had some dropped beams in it. You'd really like in your design build discussion or your value engineering discussion with the structural engineers or the designers to see if you can get all those beams so they sit on top of a flat plywood deck. Because if they sit on a flat plywood deck, you're more productive, which means it costs them less money. So as part of that design build discussion, part of that value engineering discussion, one of your goals is simplify the formwork. Sometimes it's not possible, and you've got to have the formwork carpenters come in and build a drop for a beam. It's just a hollow box that they're going to build. But it means they have to cut and form and nail, and then you have to take it all apart to get it out at some point. Generally, the formwork carpenters don't strip the forms. Generally, that's just laborers. And remember how we talked about this two-way joist slab not being very good for curves? I looked around and found one where they massacred the thing into a curve. And you see they've got a full pan and they got a half pan. This is half as wide and a half pan and a half pan. And it's almost like a pixelated edge of a circle in AutoCAD. So it's possible to do. It's just it's not native to this formwork system. If you had to make a thing that had curves in plan, what kind of concrete system do you really want? Flat slab, because you just basically make it any profile you want, right? If you have a building that's got a strong geometry, it's going to be rectangular or square or something like that, these two-way joist slabs work great. Heavy loading, long spans. What's the other advantage of a two-way waffle slab, two-way joist slab? You can offset the columns, right? Because it sheds the load. Basically, the load gets distributed across these little beam pieces out to the columns. Is there any other system that you can move the columns off the grid? You see the quiz coming, right? What other system can I move the columns off the grid? What other system? One-way joist slab, because it sits on a beam and we can move the columns back and forth along that beam, right? So we get some adjustability there. And if I have a one-way joist system, do I want to see curved partitions in the floor plan? No, because that means somebody's going to be trimming a lot of sheetrock, right, to get those things to close up against the underside of the slab. Right. There's not much concrete in the top. When these things were used as parking ramps, they suffered. You see the rebar in the top of this two-way, this used to be a waffle slab. Up in the top it was only, what is this stuff called, would you say? Welded wire mesh, right. Just exactly with the kind of reinforcing you've got in your slabs on grade, right? Exactly the same kind. Now the top of this slab kind of all disappeared, partly because they found out it didn't get poured very thick. Got poured to be about an inch and a half. So it cracked under wheel loads of the cars. And when it cracked, and this is in a cold northern climate, when it cracks, what happens next? Water gets in it and freezes and opens up the crack. And then in a parking ramp, when the car sits there, what does it do? Wintertime, you drive your nice hot car into this cold parking ramp. It melts all the stuff that comes off the underside of the car. And what's on the underside of a car in a cold climate? Salt. It just ate it. It was the best picture I ever saw of one of these things. They had a couple collapse, so now we're more attentive to the thickness of the concrete. We're more attentive to the kind of reinforcing we put in it. What kind of rebar should go in this? What color rebar? Green stuff. The green stuff is, what's the technical name for the green stuff? Come on now. Got to get you out of vacation mode. Think back, way, way back. Do one of those Wayne's World. Huh? Epoxy-coated rebar, that's what we want. The green rebar. Exactly. This is a good thing or a bad thing? This is a bad thing. So what happened here? What do you call this? Technical term for this? Blowout, right. The weight of the column has defeated the ability of the form to maintain its square at the bottom in a couple of places. And that means the concrete is going to be kind of free-form down there, right? Which, as long as there's enough room for it, maybe that's okay. But otherwise, it's a do-over probably in most cases.